Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Today's subject is diet and cancer, and our guest is Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez. He's a cancer specialist who practices here in New York City. And in part one, we addressed the current infatuation with the so-called ketogenic diet, a diet very low in carbohydrates, as a panacea for cancer. In Dr. Gonzalez's opinion, it is not a panacea. I mean, it can be useful to some extent in some cases, but it is not a one-size-fits-all approach for cancer, as some people would claim. And so that begs the question, Nick, you know, should we pursue the converse approach? You mentioned earlier a case, a patient who's alive 32 years after a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. Sounds like she's on kind of a vegetarian, high-carbohydrate diet. Should anybody who's suffering from cancer go on a macrobiotic diet or a vegetarian diet or a juicing diet? Is that the answer to all forms of cancer as well?
Of course, in the alternative world, you know, every 6 months is a new diet. Right. That the diet for everybody. You know, Ornish and Pritikin before Ornish believed, and Ornish believes that everyone should be on a vegetarian diet, 100% mm-hmm. vegetarian, low fat, less than 8%. Atkins, of course, believed people should be on a 70-75% fat diet. And they believe all people should be on, well, Ornish, the vegetarian, Atkins, the meat diet, and Reeven at Stanford, who discovered the syndrome X, metabolic syndrome, he thinks people should be on a balanced Mediterranean diet, and he insists everyone should be on the diet. Well, my mentor Kelly believed, and we believe today, that different people need different diets. You know, we have 10 basic diets that range from largely raw foods, plant-based, to an Atkins-type red meat diet. We have dozens of variations in between. Mm-hmm. Different people need different diets. With pancreatic cancer, for example, like the patient I mentioned before, we always put them on a high plant-based carbohydrate diet. They're never purely vegetarian, but usually we limit the animal protein, but it's largely carbohydrate plant-based. We have patients like multiple myeloma patients that need a high-fat diet, but rarely do we put them on a pure ketogenic diet. My average myeloma patient has seen red meat at least once a day with mm-hmm. fat and lots of animal protein and meat, dairy products and not as much carbs. So we have different diets for different people. The traditional solid tumors, tumors of the breast, lung, stomach, pancreas, colon, liver, uterus, ovary, prostate, tend to occur in people that need to be on a plant-based diet. And we find, in our theory and in our practice, that people with immune cancers like leukemia, lymphoma, myeloma, sarcomas, which are related to immune cancers, connective tissue cancers, need to be on a more high-fat animal-based diet, but even they need some carbohydrates. And so we have different diets for different people depending on their metabolism, their innate metabolism, genetics, and the cancer type that they actually might have.
So let me ask you, do you base your selection of diet on the type of cancer that a person has? In other words, a person could not even see you and just send you a biopsy report, and you say, well, it's this type of cancer, therefore the person's going to be on this diet. Or different patients with, let's say, for example, adenocarcinoma of lung, they might be, because of their individual characteristics, placed on different diets?
Yeah, well, there are subtleties. For example, anyone with adenocarcinoma of the lung is going to need to be on a plant-based diet. Typical epithelial solid tumor patients always need to be on a plant-based diet, but we have different gradations of plant-based. We have diets that allow virtually no animal protein and there's an 80 to 90% raw foods. We have cooked food diets on the vegetarian side, and less strict plant-based diets that do allow fish, eggs, and yogurt, and even less strict will allow some poultry occasionally, but still largely plant-based. So the gradations of plant-based are quite variable in our office, and we have dozens of different plant-based diets. But someone with lung cancer always is going to be on the side of needing a plant-based, more vegetarian-type diet. The amount of animal protein, or raw versus cooked, may vary from patient to patient depending on their history, genetics, and their innate metabolism, but they will be on a plant-based diet.
It seems like, from your standpoint, hematological malignancies like leukemias and lymphomas, which are actually sort of immunological or lymphatic cancers, the tendency is to have people have more in the way of animal protein and fat on those with those types of cancers.
Absolutely correct. Yeah, we find that with the immune-related, blood-related cancers, they need to be on a fair amount of red meat, fat, cheese. Atkins would be happy, you know, some carbohydrate foods, but mostly it's a kind of an animal protein, animal fat-based diet, and they seem to thrive on it. One of the patients in my Kelly book is a woman with really advanced myeloma that had chemo and failed, had multiple fractures, went on the Kelly program. He put her on red meat, I think, once a day in her case, And she had total regression of her disease, and 11 years later when I finished my study, she was alive and well. That's an impressive case, stage 4 aggressive myeloma with multiple fractures, who had total regression, even healing of the fractures under Kelly's direction after mm-hmm. she had originally failed chemo. And she was on a meat-based, a fairly high-fat diet, not a complete Atkins diet, but it was a high-fat, high-protein diet. And she did really wonderfully, and I got to know her quite well.
Well, you know, so there's a couple of theories knocking around about cancer, and some of them have to do with insulin, okay? And since insulin has some relationship to insulin-like growth factor 1, which is a growth factor for normal cells, but also a cancer promoter, some people think that, oh, you know, if you have metabolic syndrome or insulin excess, that that's going to promote your cancer. In fact, there are studies that show, for example, women with breast cancer, if they're obese or they have metabolic syndrome or diabetes, they're more likely to get a recurrence of their breast cancer. And similarly for colon cancer, the colon cancer is one of those. Many cancers, not all, but many of them seem to be insulin dependent. So does that square with your theory about maybe those are the people who need less carbohydrates, or is it more esoteric than that?
Well, we find breast cancer patients actually need to be on a high carbohydrate diet, and we have women that come to us who probably would be diagnosed by anybody else as having insulin resistance. We still put them on a high carbohydrate diet, but they're complex carbohydrates, and even things like carrot juice, which have natural sugars, we find don't really make insulin resistance worse, but actually help. You know, for example, the classic case of a group of people that eat a high carbohydrate diet, high glycemic foods like brown rice, or the Okinawans, which are touted all over the world as a long-lived people with excellent health and minimal amounts of heart disease.
What people are those?
Okinawa.
Oh, the Okinawans from the island of Okinawa. Okay.
Yeah, the long-lived Okinawans that have been studied by Western scientists, mm-hmm. which are so healthy.
And they're mostly vegetarian, right?
They're mostly vegetarian, and they actually eat a lot of high glycemic foods. For example, they eat a lot of brown rice. So the glycemic fanatics, brown rice is no better than white rice. It's a high glycemic food. And they eat lots of fruits that really have a very high glycemic index. Glycemic index, as your audience probably knows, just measures the body's response to sugar using natural sugar as compared to the way you'd respond to pure glucose. And these are high glycemic foods, but yet the Okinawans have virtually no diabetes, either type 1 or type 2. They don't get insulin resistance on a high carbohydrate fuel. And I was reading a study just last week, and the theory about why the Okinawans on a high glycemic index, high carbohydrate diet do not get insulin resistance because there's a lot of fiber in it, which blunts the action mm-hmm. of insulin-like growth factor. So we find with our patients that have insulin resistance, now some of them could need to be on a plant food type diet, some of them could need to be on more red meat, but even the ones we put on high-carb diets, if they're complex carbohydrates with a lot of fiber, the blood sugars tend to normalize. And Pritikin, you know, claimed, and even Whitaker wrote a book on diabetes, where he said diabetics should be on a vegetarian, plant-based, complex carbohydrate, beans, nuts, seeds kind of diet. And we find for some patients that works, but then there are the Atkins-type patients that get over their insulin resistance by eating fat and meat and mm-hmm. cutting down carbohydrates. So again, even then, it varies from patient to patient. And the Okinawans are a great example of people eating a high-carbohydrate diet that never develop insulin resistance and never develop diabetes. So that's, again, different people need different diets, even with insulin resistance. Of course, your reference to cancer, a lot of researchers think insulin is a growth factor. It stimulates cells to grow, which is true, and certainly no one should have excess insulin. But a lot of patients who have solid tumors like breast cancer will not do well on a meat diet, and they actually need complex carbohydrates. And the reason they develop insulin resistance is because they eat the traditional American diet, which the average American eats, I've read, up to 164 pounds of white sugar a year. And of course, that's going to create insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome. And
there are some, you know, as far as you're concerned, there are some dietary absolutes. It's not like, you know, a free fire zone. What are some of the common features of the diets that you administer to patients? You know, whether they're high protein diets inclusive of fat or whether they're ultra low protein carbohydrate based diets.
Well, first, the food should be as organic as possible. It really makes a difference. Forget that study from Stanford a year ago.
By the way, a new study just came out this week, big study, saying benefits of higher levels of antioxidants present in organic foods, less toxins and less cadmium. And that was, touted in all over the place, in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, very well done study. There are studies going back 80, 90 years from Sir Albert Howard, who was the great English agronomist who studied traditional organic practices around the world. And he found unquestionably organic food is more nutritious, high levels of virtually all the nutrients, and it doesn't have the toxic residues even 80 years ago if they were using pesticides in Western countries. And these are, you know, pesticides are neurotoxins. No one should be eating that. So the food should be as clean as possible. Organic is always best. You must avoid GMOs. Of course, if you eat organically, you're going to be missing GMOs, genetically modified foods. Avoid those. You got to eat organically. It really makes a difference. The nutritional value is better. So whether you're on a meat diet or a plant-based diet or a balanced diet, all the food should be clean. All the food should be in its most natural form. Whole foods, no processed foods, no refined carbohydrates, whether you're on a meat diet or a plant diet or a balanced diet. No white sugar, white flour, white...
By the way, this is the few times that I run into you, you know, because we don't see each other enough and we don't see each other socially. Sometimes we meet on the radio when I interview is, you know, you will meet in like an organic market or something, or you'll be carrying packages of carrots or something, or your organic meat, because I know that your diet includes, or at least last time I saw you, includes organic meat.
Oh, a fair amount, yeah. I'm not on a vegetarian diet. My wife is more on the plant-based diet. I'm more on the meat-eating diet. So I eat a fair amount of red meat and fish and poultry and cheese and eat cheese every day. So, yeah, I live by my rules. You know, I live organically. So food should be whole in its natural form as possible. If you're eating beef, it should be grass-fed, of course. Eggs should be organic. The food should be organic. Avoid pesticide. Try and get to know your local farmers. If you get it from your local farmer, you really know what's in it. So the cleaner the food, the better. Whole foods only in its natural form as possible. And whether you're on a plant diet or an animal-based diet, you need some fat. Even the vegetarians need fat. One of the mythology of Pritikin and Ornish, fat is the enemy of mankind. Of course, that's totally been debunked, even as you know, Time magazine had a cover story four or five weeks ago.
Right.
That everything we thought about fat is wrong. Saturated fat doesn't cause heart disease.
You know, when that came out, I juxtaposed it on Facebook with a previous Time magazine cover, which showed, you know, two fried eggs as the eyes and a slab of bacon that was downturned. You know, to signify, this is from 1984, to signify that fat was bad for you. Well, fast forward 30 years, and it, you know, it's the opposite. It's the opposite cover. That's how the journalistic winds blow.
Well, at least they had the honesty and integrity to redo what they claimed for years, that fat is the enemy of mankind. And they were getting that from the American Heart Association and American Cancer Society, all of them claimed fat was the enemy of mankind. We know that's not the case, but fats have to be good fats, not trans fats, not processed fats. Good fats like from avocado or grass-fed beef. Grass-fed beef is loaded with all kinds of nutrients like conjugated linoleic acid that actually have a cancer-protective effect. So when you eat naturally raised animals or organically raised produce, you get all kinds of nutrients that you're not going to get from the industrial feedlot or industrial farms. It really makes a big difference in terms of the protection against any disease, including heart disease.
And what's your take on the paleo phenomenon? That's, you know, you've been an observer on the scene for a long time, and paleo is very in these days. People eschew grains, and they eschew dairy products, and they're eating like we believe our Stone Age ancestors went ate.
Oh, yeah. You know, Perlmutter came out with his book, you know, Grains Cause Alzheimer's, and then Davis' book on the wheat belly diet. Mm-hmm. Well, the problem is it depends on the wheat, it depends on the person. You know, our meat eater shouldn't be eating a lot of grains, but I have so many, like the woman I just discussed with the pancreatic cancer, our own patients with pancreatic cancer that got well, we have them on lots of grains. These genetic vegetarians actually do real well with grains,
mm-hmm.
and they don't develop insulin resistance, and they don't develop diabetes. They don't get any of that, and they just thrive on it. They need grains. And I understand the whole thing about the greens today aren't the same as they were 100 years ago, but still, if you're a genetic vegetarian and you're on organic sprouted grain breads tend to be less allergenic, easier to digest, and more nutritious. They tolerate it. For example, I myself, even though I'm somewhat on the meat side, I do need some grains. I don't feel well unless I eat them, and I've experimented, you know, for 30 years with diet. So I eat them, and I don't go crazy, and so far I don't seem to have Alzheimer's, and maybe, you know, much dismay. May happen, but it hadn't happened yet.
Only according to the National Institutes of Health. They might suspect you of being mentally...
That's right. The National Institutes of Health are convinced. Well, they actually think I'm very wily, because I was able to write this book. They don't have that happen. They figured out, you know...
Or perhaps the NCI, the National Cancer Institute, they're the ones who...
Yeah, both of them, the NIH and the NCI.
Right.
So they were both involved. So... again, different people need different diets, even in terms of grains. So the paleo diet is another fad. You know, everyone should be on a high-fat, high-protein diet. I have patients coming into me before they saw me were on the paleo diet, which they thought they would lose weight, and they gained weight. I have one woman, a young woman, who gained 20 to 30 pounds on the paleo diet, and she's very discouraged. She thought, I thought I would lose weight. I put her on a fair amount of carbohydrates. To her horror, although she was willing to do what I said because the reason she came to see me is she felt terrible on the paleo diet, and she's already lost about 15 pounds in 3 months.
Wow.
So for her, what happened is on the paleo diet, it wasn't the right diet for her metabolism. So she was constantly hungry, and she was eating, you know, 4 avocados a day.
Right.
And she just was always hungry. I put her on carbs, and her appetite went down. She started losing weight. She needed carbs. She wasn't a meat eater. She didn't need a paleo diet. So the first rule in my office, one diet isn't for everybody. So as soon as an expert says everyone should be on this diet, I back off and say, I don't think so, because we have patients that thrive on grains, even though grains are currently the grains are now replacing fat as the horror of mankind, and that will pass too. And yes, there are people who shouldn't eat grains in celiac disease. Patients, of course, should not touch gluten grains. I understand all that. But grains are not the enemy of mankind. You know, in the Bible, in the Old Testament, they were sacred food used at temple worship. So if grains are okay for God, they're okay for me. But again, our meat eaters shouldn't be eating a whole lot of grains. Some of them don't tolerate them. But it depends on the person.
Right. Well, so by what means can we discern what diet is the best fit for a given person? For example, we have PAT solutions like Dr. Dedama wrote the blood type diet, and that outlines in very simple terms, just get your blood type tested, and type O's are this, and type A's are this, AB's are that, and so on. And do you place any stock in that? Does that shed light on the optimal diet?
I respect the blood type diet approach simply because Dedama recognizes that different people need different diets, and he did the world a favor by doing that, and that book was a big bestseller. So
right, just by virtue of offering people that option of customizing their diets.
That not everyone's the same, but he had 4 basic diets. We use 10 basic diets. Kelly knew Dedama's father, who was the first. He was the first in that line to start talking about blood typing, 35 years ago, and Kelly knew his father. Kelly never thought much of it. I don't find it that accurate. I think there's about a 50% correlation. For example, they claim that type O should be on meat. We have type O's with breast cancer that need to be on a plant-based diet and thrive on it. And I have type O's that went on the meat diet and gained weight and didn't feel good, and we put them on the more plant-based diet and they thrived. There is some correlation, but not the 100% that the books would claim. We find it about 50%. We don't use it in our practice. In terms of your question, whenever I lecture, I always get asked, well, okay, this is all great. It sounds wonderful, 32-year survivors of pancreatic cancer. How can I tell what diet I need to be on? Well, we have, tests that we run in our office, but it's really quite simple. It sounds almost just too simple. You can go by what foods you crave. Forget what the experts say, the paleo diet, the Ornish diet, Atkins diet. If you really crave bacon and fatty meat, I guarantee you're on the meat-eating side, because a genetic vegetarian will gag at the thought of bacon. A genetic vegetarian will eat a salad for lunch and feel great for 8 hours. A genetic meat-eater eats a salad and feels like they haven't eaten anything, feels fatigued, needs to eat right away. So you can go by what you need. Kelly used to say balanced people are in between. They always do well at a buffet. They like a variety of foods, plant foods and animal foods. So as simple as it sounds, our brain is smarter than any expert, and our brain will tend to lead us to the right foods. Yes, I know everybody likes chocolate cake. No,
right,
none of us
right.
Eating chocolate cake.
Yeah, I mean, what if I gravitate towards a little Johnny Walker Black and Rocky Road ice cream? Should I indulge?
No, we're talking about whole foods, wholesome foods, organic foods. But usually, interestingly enough, again, something I learned from Kelly, he's very sage in his own way, that if somebody craves a food, there's usually a reason. For example, like this woman that was on the paleo diet was constantly hungry and constantly craving carbs. She needed to be on carbs. There was a reason why she needed to be on carbs. And then she started sneaking candy bars because she was so desperate and felt terrible.
Yeah, that's, I think, people sometimes go for inferior forms of the whole food. And I think that may be part of the problem. Instead of having organic meat, they're going to have greasy bologna luncheon meats
that's
or something
right.
like that.
There was one case when Kelly was still seeing patients, when I was first going through his records, I used to watch him work with patients. He had a patient that came and had been on his program for about 6 months. And almost tearfully admitted that she was craving chocolate. It's like a sin in front of Dr. Kelly, the great nutrition doctor.
Right.
And she felt morally inferior, and she was craving chocolate. Kelly said, how bad is the craving? She said, Dr. Kelly, you know I do your program. I'm absolutely craving it. I feel like I dream about it. He said, you need some. He said, and I almost fell out of my chair because I was being so pure. You never touch white sugar.
Yeah.
He said, there's something in the chocolate you need right now. And he said for the next 6 weeks, so he was very experienced clinically, he said for the next 6 weeks, eat chocolate as much as you want every day. Stick to the rest of the diet. And she did, and 2 months later she came back and she said, I did it for 6 weeks, almost on schedule. I stopped craving it. Of course, we now know that chocolate has mood enhancers, amino acids mm-hmm. that are mood enhancers. It has lots of magnesium. And Kelly said to me, you have to learn to listen to the patient, because often even a bizarre craving tells you something about their...
Well Nick, I'll let you know when I stopped craving chocolate. Maybe we'll do an interview next year, and I'll share my progress with you.
Okay, that's great.
Because I do tend to have a little Jones on dark chocolate. But, I kind of keep it limited. Maybe I'm just not letting the floodgates open, and,
This is a true story. I was stunned when he said that, because I was so enthusiastic about his work, all his organic stuff. Mm-hmm. He was telling him to eat chocolate. He said, if you can get organic, fine, but if you can't get organic, just eat it.
Yeah.
And he said, your craving will go away. And she said she never ate chocolate again. I kept in touch with her over the years. She never, it was a six-week period, and then she never craved it again. And he didn't say, just have a little piece. He said, you eat as much as you like. And she was really afraid, because it came from Kelly, so she did it. And when she came back, it was in extraordinary storage. She said she craved it, ate it, and then gradually just made her sick. She didn't want it anymore. And he said there was something in the chocolate, probably. We now know, of course, chocolate has lots of antioxidants.
Yeah, it's very beneficial for cognition and for, for circulation. So clearly there's some helpful substances there, and there's some mood enhancing and mood balancing substances as well. So, okay, well, fascinating discussion, and, just the tip of the iceberg of what you offer in your practice. So what's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? How can patients find out more about you and your practice? First of all, to read the series of articles that is in,
naturalhealth365.com.
Just click on the ketogenic diet and cancer section of the website, naturalhealth365.com. Very fascinating discussion, a lengthy discussion in 8 parts. And then the details on your website, what can people find there?
We have a pretty extensive website that links to other places, too, that has lots of information about what we do and how we use different diets, et cetera, a lot of theory and some of our results and case reports. And as you said earlier, it's www.dr-gonzalez, and my name is Z at the end, .com, dr-gonzalez.com. And there's lots of information there. People are interested in becoming a patient. There's information how to become a patient, information about the theories, some of the legitimate research we've done over the years that gave
results. And I might say that, your therapies center around diet, but they also involve the use of supplements. And very unique supplements that you embrace, not the standard supplements that are used in the treatment of cancer. There are many things that are, kind of the tried and true phytonutrients that are thought to be beneficial for cancer. But you have your own targeted approach to cancer, which is unique. But it does involve a committed patient who's willing to undertake a disciplined program of diet and the use of lots and lots of supplements.
That's true. Our average cancer patient will take 200 capsules a day, spread through the day. A lot of them are enzymes, but it's a lot of pills.
I said that to make my patients feel better. If you think it's bad coming to me, wait till you see what Dr. Gonzalez recommends.
Oh, no, yeah. Mine is for, we treat really advanced sick patients, and you have to get real aggressive. So, Ron's doing a great job with his approach, and I think it's wonderful what he's offering to patients. Ours is for the really sick, advanced patients that are willing to work their tail feathers off to get well.
Exactly. I mean, if you've got an imminently life-threatening disease, that's a great motivator, and you will discipline yourself to spend a lot of time meeting out your supplements and taking them throughout the day. So that, I think, bespeaks a high degree of commitment that you elicit from your patients.
Yeah, okay. We don't lie about that, absolutely.
Great. Okay, so thank you very much for joining us. And once again, your practice is located in New York City. The name is Gonzalez with 2 Z's. And it's a pleasure having you on the program. We'll invite you back to talk about some other cancer themes very soon.
Well, thanks so much for letting me talk about Dr. Seyfried's work.
Yeah, I think you really covered it very comprehensively. Thank you for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.